I think the absolute best thing that you can do is smack it, you know, 2 in the afternoon when it's as hot as it can possibly be. That's when you're training. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the latest episode of the Matchbox Podcast powered by Ignition Coach Co. I'm your host, Adam Sabin, and this week we do a shallow dive on creatine supplementation before taking a deeper dive into the topic of heat acclimation for those early season races. Today's show is also brought to you by Flow Formulas. Just when you thought you had all the time in the world to dial in your nutrition, with the snap of a finger, it seems like the race season is already right in front of us. Get on top of your nutrition game now by heading over to flowformulas.com and make sure to use the discount code MATCHBOX when checking out. Speaking of nutrition, Ignition is hosting an 8-week course focused on optimized nutrition for the endurance athlete out there that anyone in the ether can sign up for. The course kicks off this week, so sign up now. And one final note, if you're currently a coach or interested in getting into the coaching profession, Ignition is looking for talented individuals to add to our coaching roster. Every coach has the opportunity to learn the ins and outs of endurance coaching and training under the guidance of Dylan and Drew, while also coming alongside the fleet of Ignition coaches in a collaborative environment where all of us play a role in making each other better coaches. Send an email to info@ignitioncoachco.com with your resume, backstory, and any questions you have about working as a coach with Ignition. And as always, if you like what you hear, please share this with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if you have any questions for the show, you can drop us an email at matchboxpod@gmail.com with email title The Matchbox Podcast, or you can head over to ignitioncoachco.com and fill out the Matchbox Podcast listener question form. All right, let's get into it. Okay, the first question that comes in this week, say in episode 76, Dylan briefly mentioned the health and performance benefits of creatine supplementation. It'd be great to learn more about this. Could you maybe expand on that topic?
Wow. It's a very general, open-ended question. So creatine is obviously traditionally used by strength athletes because its primary benefit in athletics is strength, which is why you don't hear about it that much from cyclists or other endurance athletes. It's pretty, I would say, I don't want to use the word conclusive, but it's likely not going to help you in endurance sports like cycling. And if anything, the added water weight is probably not helpful for you. That being said, I used it during the off season this year when I was weight training pretty heavily. I was actually able to lift heavier than I usually am. Now, whether that's due to the fact that I'm naturally getting stronger as I accumulate more years of lifting, or whether it was the creatine, I don't know. It's hard to say. And then beyond that, I don't know, man. I should have prepped for this question better, and I would have had a list of benefits in front of me. But the benefits do go beyond just strength training.
So during that episode, you had mentioned that you were considering keeping, continuing to use creatine throughout the season.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of had led you to that conclusion?
Well, I think that the most that I was going to do is, I was taking it every day, and the most I would probably do is take it, I don't know, once a week or twice a week, because I did accumulate a pretty significant amount of water weight, and I've kind of stopped taking it, and I have lost that water weight. So for most races where weight matters, it's probably not a good idea to take it. I could possibly see taking it for flat races that are going to end in a sprint. So will I continue to take it? I don't know. Maybe if I'm doing a flat race that ends with a sprint, I'll take it for the week leading up to that. If not, maybe I'll take it once a week or something.
And were you taking it in combination with anything else, or like, were you taking it with any other kind of pre-workout,
no,
supplements? Okay.
No, I wasn't doing, What do the bodybuilders do pre-workout?
BCAAs.
Well, that, I mean, they do so many different, things, but
what about caffeine or anything like that? Were you supplementing with caffeine before your gym workouts?
No, not really.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was your loading cycle? Like, what did that look like?
So they, I need to remember the amounts off the top of my head here. I think that it's
10 to 20 grams. And then your
I don't want to 5 grams.
Right?
I don't want to say the wrong amounts here because then somebody's going to take that as gospel and take the wrong amounts. I should have prepared better for this episode, but as the listeners can probably tell, we don't prep before these questions. We kind of just do them. So
Caitlin's right. It's like a week or two of 10 grams. And then from that, you do just 5 grams a day. And they say that if you're going to do the 10 grams, just split it. Do like 5 in the morning, 5 at night or something like that.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't dissolve very well in water. Like, you have to mix it up a lot.
Yeah.
It is supposedly... You just do 5 grams every day.
Yeah. It is supposedly supposed to speed recovery, so it potentially could be a good thing to take during the base season when you don't really care how heavy you are and you just want to recover fast.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's neurological benefits as well. I can't go into detail on what those are or how strong those benefits are, but
I did pull up a study by Stan Kuhler and colleagues that says the effects of creatine supplementation on cognitive performance. And the takeaway from this one is that supplementing creatine may benefit cognition as muscle and brain cells use creatine to access more energy when demand is high. They store creatine as phosphocreatine, which acts to regenerate the energy providing ATP.
Yeah, I mean, that's the main reason I take it. And I do the same thing Dylan does. I basically take it during the off season, then a couple weeks before the first race, I'll probably stop taking it. And the main reason is that I'm not convinced that it makes me like direct benefit on the bike, exactly what Dylan said. But I am very convinced that it can help me increase the amount of weight I can lift in the gym. And so during the time of the year when my strength training is a bit of a higher priority, meaning like early in the year and base season, I'll take it to try and get a little more out of my strength training than maybe I would if I didn't take it, and then stop taking it once that stops being a priority. So I took it last year for maybe 4 or 5 months, all the way up until like my big race season started. And then this year, I'm taking it right now, and I'll keep taking it until probably like the Mid-South or something. So like another month.
And were you guys taking beta-alanine with that at all?
Yeah, those are the only two supplements I take. Unless you count caffeine, but I just drink caffeine every day.
So beta-alanine.
Every morning, I mix my creatine and my beta-alanine with my orange juice.
Do you take beta-alanine year-round?
Yeah.
I only take beta-alanine during race season.
And so you like flip-flop. Yeah.
Sure. Because beta-alanine helps with... it's probably the most helpful for your 5 minute power.
Uh-huh.
Which, I mean, 5 minute power is pretty important for most races.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean,
I think the reason I take beta alanine year round is because I know there's a buildup process, and I'm like, well, I've already built it up, so I'll just keep doing it. And then I don't have to like do the whole buildup process again or whatever.
So buildup, you mean like there's a loading cycle?
Yeah, you have to take a load.
I think it like takes like 6 weeks before it to actually be effective. You have to like take it every day. But it's not like creatine where you take more of it. It just takes that long of the daily dose or whatever.
Interesting.
I think it's 5 grams for that as well.
Mm. Yeah, I'm like doing a VO2 max block right now, and I'm actually almost at the end of it. And I started taking beta alanine. I think it was probably at the end of the last 4 week cycle. So it's maybe like 3 weeks ago now. And it's like, it's in a pre-workout mix, but it hasn't been 6 weeks though.
Maybe it's not kicked in yet,
but it's like the pre-workout mix that I take has like a ton of caffeine in it and beta alanine and creatine and kinds of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, if you're taking that,
it just gets me caffeine amped, dude.
I mean, yeah, the beta alanine ain't nothing. Like the caffeine is what's going to do you, like that's going to do way more for you than the,
yeah, for sure.
I, like I said, caffeine is like, if you count that as a supplement, but I did buy a bottle of like caffeine pills. I was going to experiment. Like normally I drink, you know, one or two cups of coffee in the morning, but on like my big workout days, I'll still drink my normal amount of caffeine, like from coffee. And maybe I was going to start taking those pills before the workout, like an hour before the workout.
How much caffeine is in a pill? Yeah,
I know.
Should be about 200 mgs.
Yeah. And I'll probably end up with 200 from my two cups of coffee. So I'm pushing the limit of, like, they say 3 to 400 per day is like beyond that is when it starts to be not good for your health. But yeah, I would only do it for big workout days.
Like, yeah, that's what I was going to say. Is like, if you have a day where you're expending excess energy, I don't know if that same rule applies.
Well, there's also a point at which caffeine stops being beneficial to performance, like it tapers off, and
yeah, like diminishing returns.
It depends on how much you weigh, but it is, I mean, that's around 200 to 250 migs,
yeah, in your system still.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so if you drink coffee and then you don't do your workout until 5 hours later,
The caffeine pill. Yeah, I've only done it once, and it seemed to like work. I mean, it seemed like I felt better on my workout.
Have you guys ever tried bicarb?
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that? Does that work?
I think so. I've watched a lot of review videos that say
digested.
They didn't experience
skin?
Like any change. No, the Martin the bicarb
Martin stuff,
product.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They're the only Blaine ones that have
both
a digestible,
have seen,
right?
I think
like that's
so.
The only one on the market right now that's a digestible. Other than that, you can get the stuff you put on your legs, which is like, I don't know about this. But digesting it seems like a much better approach than
Caitlin,
if you can handle it, obviously.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more about your experience with that.
So it's like this two-part system. You have this, it's basically like the same consistency as the Martin gel. And they give you like this little bowl. It's like you eat it like soup. It's crazy. And then you put the little bicarb pellets in there. And I think you do it an hour. I did this end of last season.
It looks crazy. It's like silver. It looks like straight up
a little
metal.
Gnarly.
It looks like something you would eat in space. Seriously.
It's a little gnarly to get it down for sure, because it's a large volume of this goop that you have to put down. And it feels like you're just like swallowing air, so you're a little burpy after. But I saw really, really good numbers in a workout I did after, and then did it before a race, and it was probably my best start power in a race that I've ever had. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Training Peaks has an article that says boost your performance using simple baking soda.
Yeah. I was going to say baking soda is the old school form.
I know, and that's where a lot of
You have to get the portion right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
According to your body weight. And that's what Martin does. They have different dosages based on your weight, which is good. So otherwise, like, there are peer reviewed studies that like can't come up with a better term than these people experienced explosive diarrhea on the treadmill.
That's literally
yeah.
I know somebody who's tried the just baking powder or baking soda. He was doing track races. Actually, I don't want to name him. I know he wouldn't care if I named him, but he told me he did it like for three races, and for two out of three races it was amazing. And then there was the one race where it was like he was running to the porta pot because he like almost didn't make it.
Yeah.
He was like, yeah, after that, I was a little hesitant.
There looks like there's a couple other products out there beyond just the Martin stuff. One of them is a potassium bicarb, which I'd have to look more into that. I haven't heard of that.
I think it's pronounced Morton
instead of Martin.
Yeah.
Was that bugging you this whole time?
it wasn't bugging me that much, but we mispronounced it at least five times already.
Okay. Sorry. Morton.
Yeah, maybe
we're way
a
off topic.
Of
are we going to keep Martin talking about creatine, or are we just doing supplements?
I do want to mention, though, I think it is, I can see the argument to take it regularly for people who are plant-based, because although it's naturally occurring in your body, it's, you get it from animal protein. So,
what form would you take in that? Like just your basic supplementation, like normal supplements?
Yeah, I think it's creates
monohydrate.
Yeah, exactly. Man, you're asking so many specific questions about creatine. But I feel like I need to be.
And so, is that a vegan supplement?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dude, a lot of supplements are not. That's what I was asking.
Yeah.
If people are like super interested in supplements as a whole, we're doing a 8-week masterclass via Ignition. You can go to the Ignition Coach Co. website and sign up for this 8-week nutrition masterclass. We have a nutritionist that kind of helps us at Ignition Coach Co. And she wanted, it was her idea to do like an 8-week kind of overview on nutrition for sports performance. And one of the topics, like 1 week, all she's going to talk about is supplements. And in the conversations I've had with her, she's told me that creatine is like the most researched supplement almost in the world.
Yeah.
So it's, a lot of, and she knows a lot about it. So she could definitely answer a lot of these questions and give you very precise answers.
Anybody who's concerned about safety of creatine, because I know with supplements people are concerned about it, it's definitely safe, super heavily researched. There are a lot of benefits to it, very, very minimal downsides to it. Obviously for an endurance sport athlete, probably the biggest downside is the water weight gain, because I know everybody is trying to be as light as possible, but I think that if I wasn't an endurance sport athlete, I would take it more regularly just for all the other benefits.
Sure.
This is like, this is probably just me being goofy, but, for the longest time, I thought creatine was on the banned substance list. I guess I was equating creatine to steroids because, like, every time you hear about creatine, it's just strength training. Sure. And so for some reason, I thought creatine was on the banned substance list. So I never even, like, gave it the time of day until a few years ago when I was like, oh, wait, it's not a banned. It's not banned. I could take creatine. And I was like, oh, let me look into this.
Yeah, I want to say, like, back when I was in college and not that I like am not concerned about banned substances now, but like, you know, when you're in college, like, you don't want to accidentally take a banned substance and lose your scholarship and stuff like that. And I remember that was when like energy drinks were like first starting to come out and they're like really popular and they had all kinds of like taurine and creatine and guarana and all this like stuff in it that people didn't know a ton about. And I remember our coach telling us like, yeah, we should probably stay away from some of that until more research comes out, because I think there was a time where some of that was on the banned, like the NCAA banned list. Mm-hmm. That was 12 years ago. So
Okay.
It's changed quite a bit. Anyways, yeah, let's move on to this next question. This is I think a pretty good one. So this one comes from Jordan. Jordan says, question for the Matchbox podcast. I live in Utah where it's about 40 degrees in February, and I'm racing in Puerto Rico in a few weeks where it will be about 85 degrees. Any tips for heat acclimation beforehand? I have access to a sauna and can ride indoors with no fan. I will only be in Puerto Rico for 2 days before the race.
Yeah. This is a good question that I know more about. I wish I had more info off the top of my head about creatine that I could have given you, but this one I do have info off the top of my head.
Okay, let's hear it.
Okay, so
we're waiting, dude.
So, for context, I'm guessing that Jordan is going to be racing the UCI XC races down there.
Cool, and it's going to be hot, and he's not going to be used to the heat. All right, so there are a couple things that you can do in this scenario. Obviously, if you're training for a hot race, I think that the best thing that you can do, which is not an option here, is just train in the heat. Train in the hottest part of the day. I know when it's hot in the summer, most people like to train early or like to train late to avoid the heat. But if you're training specifically for a hot race, I think the absolute best thing that you can do is smack it, you know, 2 PM when it's as hot as it can possibly be. That's when you're training. And it doesn't have to be every workout. If it's a really important workout, like a interval session, maybe you actually do want to do that in cooler temperatures so that you can do it at higher quality. But I would say your endurance rides, you know, make sure it's hot when you're doing those. If that's not an option, which is in this case, there are a couple things that you can do. So if you have a sauna, that's a great way to do it. Probably the recommendation here would be to get in the sauna as soon as you can after your ride. So go for your ride, hop in the sauna, you know, crank it up to, I don't know, mine, I have like a little portable sauna that goes up to 140 and I sit in it at 140 for 45 minutes after I ride when I'm trying to heat acclimate.
Yeah, I think 140 is usually regarded as like the minimum effective dose for that. I mean, you could crank it way up, but usually 140 is kind of like, if you're going to stay in there for longer, you know, 30, 40 minutes.
140 is pretty challenging to stay in for more than 45 minutes. Like it feels uncomfortably hot. So that's an option. There are people that purposefully ride on the trainer with no fan, to heat acclimate. That's an option too. There's some people that go even crazier and they wear, you know, I don't know, like they purposely wear more clothes on the trainer with no fan so that they get as hot as possible.
Whoa. You've worn more clothes than you should have in the middle of the summer. Haven't you gone out with like long sleeves?
Yeah, I have done that. It's usually not the middle of the summer. It's usually late spring when I'm trying to acclimate for a race that I know is going to be hot. By the middle of summer, I'm acclimated, but
don't visit Dylan's house in the month of May leading up to Unbound because he literally has his heat on at like 90 degrees to try and heat acclimate. And if you visit his house, it's like walking into a sauna. You're like, what the heck, dude?
Yeah, I've stopped doing that. I don't know how effective it is to just like live in a hot house. I'll look as if I'm going out for a ride that's 40 degrees, but it's actually 70 degrees. You know, that's how much clothes I'm wearing. It's difficult to say how effective that is because I'm going to be honest. You can put on a lot of clothes, but if you're actually out in the open with wind on you,
it doesn't feel as much. Yeah.
You don't sweat nearly as much as if you're stuck on the trainer.
Yep.
I think the most effective way to do this is be on a trainer.
Yeah.
So
that's what I've done in the past. I'll do periodically is trainer work with no fan. Like that's important. As soon as you turn that fan on, I mean, it drops, you know, perception wise, it probably drops 20 degrees.
Yeah.
That makes a huge difference. And I've also done extra layers on the trainer, like to the extent where I've gone outside for a ride when it's 15 degrees out and the exact same stuff I'm wearing, I'll wear it for like an hour on the trainer afterwards. So like, you know, 3, 4, 5 layers, with no fan. And it's just like last year I was doing this in the lead up to BWR Arizona.
Then you have to like wash all those clothes because they're drenched in sweat,
well,
right?
You're kind of hopefully
you wash all your clothes anyways.
What if you go outside for a ride? I'll wear a jersey like 5 times before I not a short sleeve jersey,
gross,
a long,
dude.
A long sleeve jersey because usually on my I'll have a base layer and a jersey on.
Why are you admit
my
you
long
be
sleeve jersey?
This on the podcast.
My long sleeve jersey is on the outside and it's not even touching my skin, and I'm like,
okay, yeah,
still
I,
clean.
I, I get
okay,
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But if it's drenched in sweat, I'm like,
oh no, dude. By the end, even if I'm just doing so this winter before my VO2 max training block, I did a month of just endurance riding, and I did all of my trainer rides inside with no fan. And just doing like an endurance ride for an hour and a half with no fan, like everything is so drenched. I mean, it is crazy how
I would do that
saturated
too, but I would only
gets.
Wear bibs, like so that I don't end up. So then I only have one sweaty garment to wash.
Oh, dude, you got to take it up a notch. You got to put some layers on.
I was actually doing that on all my trainer rides, but not. I'm not so much worried or concerned about heat. Acclimatization. That was not right. But altitude acclimating, and I'm like, because don't they have isn't there crossover between heat and altitude?
Yeah, but Drew, you riding in January with no fan on the trainer will probably do almost nothing for you come Crusher.
Yeah, but I guess my thought was
July.
Like, oh, I'm on the trainer, so
you
I
might as well
just not turn the fan on.
Okay, yeah. So. I guess here's a question is if you're not necessarily trying to heat acclimate, like let's say you're going to do a race that's actually not going to be hot, right? You know, it's not going to be hot, which, you know, a lot of times you can't predict the weather, so you don't know that. But depending on what time of year the race falls, blah, blah, blah. Then is it still worth heat acclimating? I think that some would argue yes, because some of the benefit that you get from heat acclimation helps endurance sports in general, but I would argue that you shouldn't go overboard with it at all because riding in that sort of heat will reduce the quality of those rides. You can't go as hard when it's that hot.
Yeah, and that's what I was gonna say too. You kind of touched on this, Dylan, but you know, like if whenever you're doing workouts specifically to induce heat acclimation, you should be careful that which workouts you're choosing. And I wouldn't recommend doing any intensity workouts because a couple reasons. One, it's going to reduce the quality, but two, it's going to drastically increase the training stress. Like it's not going to increase your actual TSS, but the training load that your body's experiencing is going to be increased quite a bit. So your recoverability after that workout is going to be a challenge. So
do you
really don't want to do that too often because you're going to train yourself into a hole, especially when you're early on in the acclimation process. It's one thing once you're like 2-3 weeks into it and you're like getting pretty used to the heat exposure. But you know, the first few weeks, I wouldn't do any intensity.
Do you think on those days where you're on the trainer doing the heat training, and you said it's not going to affect your power, so it's not going to affect your TSS, but do you think it would make sense to swap those out for your heart rate TSS? Because I would think it should mean your heart rate is higher, right? If you're doing,
sure.
If it's higher.
Yeah, I think that's valid. I think you should definitely keep an eye on heart rate.
Yeah, that's what I'm kind of saying. You know, it's like if the power isn't changing, then maybe your heart rate is.
Well, your power is probably going to change too. I mean, your power is probably going to decrease.
Yeah.
What I mean by TSS is like, if anything, yeah, your TSS is going to go down because your power is going to decrease because the quality of your workout is going to decrease. So what you're saying is maybe you should use TSS from heart rate just to get a more accurate
physiological depiction of
what the response is. And yeah, right. I think that's valid. And I would definitely keep an eye more on heart rate in those workouts than I would on, you know, or RPE is fine, you know, than just basing off of power. You know, like if you get an hour into a no fan trainer ride and like holding 200 watts is all of a sudden like feeling like a struggle, then yeah, you should probably start backing off the power a little bit.
Well, 200 watts is relative, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, like if that's what your, you know, endurance baseline is.
Yeah, there you go. Endurance baseline would be a better
way. We all know you're doing 240 watts. It's fine.
Yeah, I know. What if my FTP is only 210? Like.
Yeah. So, and one thing that I was going to mention here, the type of race that you're preparing for will also play a factor in this. And I think, I think in this case here, like a cross country mountain bike race, I think it's very important to come in at least somewhat heat acclimated because the starts are super important. Like if you're not heat acclimated, what can happen is your like cardiovascular response to the heat and the effort can be like very detrimental to like not just the performance but also like your body's like physical state to where like it can be like actual like heat shock you know. So I think in this case here, like it's really important for Jordan here to do some of these, you know, whether it's, you know, I like Dylan said, I wouldn't do it. I don't know if I would do every single workout, you know, in this way, you know, or hop in the sauna after every single workout, just because then you are taking on quite a bit of excess load, like training stress during this, you know, 3 weeks or 4 weeks leading up to this. But, you know, at least a couple times a week, I would say, you know, to do this. And the cool thing with heat acclimation too, and I think we've maybe talked about this in the past, is the adaptations come on rather quick. You know, you only need a couple, 2-3 weeks of this to induce some like pretty good, adaptations. So, I mean, that's part of, you know, Drew, it's like, you know, if you're doing heat acclimation to prepare for Unbound right now, like it's just not relevant. And you don't want to carry that kind of excess training load for 6 months. But if you've got an important race coming up in a few weeks, then yeah, I think it's important to do this.
The one thing that I'll say to make to your point, Adam, like, is it more or less important for certain types of races? I don't disagree at all that heat acclimation is important to perform well in a cross-country mountain bike race. But I would also say that the longer the race is, the more important the heat acclimation is, because the heat is not like altitude in that altitude affects you immediately from the start of the race. Whereas heat, the longer that you're in the heat, the more dehydrated you get and the more the heat affects you over the course of the race. So the longer the race is in the heat, the more the heat will affect you.
Yeah. Yeah. So you know, one of the things with heat acclimation is, you know, one of the effects that you will experience is your body will start perspirating sooner. And like the levels, like the volume of perspiration will fluctuate. Typically it'll increase. So like in a cross country race, like you want to get that evaporative cooling pretty quick. Like you don't want to wait till an hour in before your body starts producing sweat, because by then you're probably starting to overheat too much. But at the same time, like what you're talking about here with the longer races, you need to know how much your body's going to be sweating, what kind of, you know, sodium levels you're going to be, you know, losing during, you know, with your sweat, so that you can fuel and hydrate properly too. And just the chronic, mm-hmm. you know, excess stress that your body is going to go through over 6 hours compared to 60 minutes.
Sure. Yeah.
Adam, you have some personal experience with the whole, you know, passing out after a race. Didn't that happen to you last summer?
Yeah, it usually happens once a year for some reason.
Once a year.
Yeah, where I get like heat stroke, basically. And it's kind of unpredictable. Like I haven't figured out like why it happens, but it's usually once a year. I haven't had it happen more than once a year. And it's usually earlier in the season, May, mm-hmm. June timeframe. And like that's early for me, like as far as like being outside training in warm weather. It doesn't usually get like short sleeve weather until at least April or early May here. So, but it's usually not like the first workout where it's hot though. That's the weird thing. Like last mm-hmm. year, like I was fine when I went down to BWR Arizona last year, and it wasn't hot, but it was hot compared to what I'd been training in. Yeah. So I don't know. I haven't figured out what it is yet. I think it happens when I have just more like chronic stress going on in my life. Like when I have more stress off the bike than typical. Like I remember mm-hmm. last year it happened, right after I'd gotten my new like drop bar mountain bike, and I'd spent like 3 or 4 hours in the garage, like swapping tires and swapping components, like doing a bunch of stuff, like in my hot garage for the 4 hours before the race was that night. So I think like I just built up a ton of like excess stress from being exposed to the heat, like in the hot garage, and like, oh, I gotta get this bike finished before tonight so I can ride it, and like all this, like, you know, just like excess stress off the bike. Cause I was like really fit at the time, and I had like been training in the heat, and like the heat wasn't affecting my workouts at all. But I think it's something else. Like I think that there's excess stress elsewhere that I think contributes. And I think that's what I've got to be careful of.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We've talked about like brain training and central governor theory, and basically like the concept is our body has physical limits, but mental limits, and our brain does a really good job at not letting our bodies get to our true physical limits, or things like that happen where you get heat stroke and you pass out. But there's like one major curveball in that whole thing, and it's always heat. Like no matter what, heat, all your brain is really good at it unless it's really hot outside. And then for whatever reason, your brain is not very good when it's hot outside at like letting you not go over those physical limits. And that's when you see more people passing out and getting heat stroke and all that. And that's because your brain for some reason like screws it up when it's hot outside, which is kind of interesting.
I can see that.
I did want to ask some specifics for this guy in his training. So say he does an hour, 2 hour endurance ride on the trainer, no fan. If he immediately gets a cold shower to bring his core body temp, which I would assume would reduce some of that training stress, is he going to lose any adaptation from that?
Yeah, I wouldn't do cold therapy anytime after training, because there's not that much research on it for endurance sports specifically, but there is research on strength training, and doing cold therapy immediately following strength training actually hinders adaptation. If you're going to do cold therapy, I wouldn't do it immediately following exercise.
Well, I'm just talking about purely from like the heat adaptation side, because
I mean, sure.
To get your core body temp down after 2 hours without the fan, I feel like that would be beneficial. What do you think, Adam?
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of agree with Dylan. Would the goal there just be to try and improve recovery?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. I'd have to look into it, but I want to say that it will reduce the adaptation effects, which if you're trying to do the workout, the heat acclimation workout to induce heat acclimation, you want to maximize the amount of benefits you're going to get from that. So, I don't know. I'd have to look into that because I'm pretty sure if you do it that way, it will decrease the adaptation effects.
Could we also say, to kind of go keep going down the road of recovery, it's really, we, in general, I think people sleep better when they're cooler instead of when they're hotter. So this isn't something that you'd want to do late in the day, right? Like, you don't want to do a really hot trainer ride at 9 p.m. and then try to go to bed an hour later, because like, your body's going to be so hot that it's going to be really hard for you to fall asleep. And then
agreed,
your quality of sleep is not going to be very good.
Agreed. Yeah, that's where I would introduce the cold shower maybe later. You know, maybe if your workout's in the morning, you do a cold shower before bed or something.
I mean, I also
don't know about that, because your body also responds to what it's exposed to. So like, if you do a cold shower, like, it does kind of reset and recalibrate your body's like thermostat or whatever, but your body's then going to try and respond by heating itself up. So like, they also say like, you probably shouldn't do cold showers right before bed, because then your core temperature afterwards is going to increase. You know, but maybe you do it like a couple hours after or something.
I think that if you can help it, also, you should just, in general, as a rule, exercising right before bed is not the best idea.
True. Yeah.
You know, whether it's a hot exercise or a cold exercise, it's just elevating your heart rate, and then you'll probably have a harder time falling asleep.
Mm-hmm.
Some people don't have that luxury. They have to get on the trainer at 10 at night. But
so if I have to stay up till 1 a.m. tomorrow, I should do my workout later in the day, because that'll help me to stay up later, right?
Why are you staying up till 1 a.m.? No one has to stay up till 1 a.m. for any reason.
Well, I am, actually. I'm going to be up at 12 a.m. on Friday night. Our church does a 24 hours of prayer, and nobody signed up for the 12 to 1 spot. And so I signed up for that spot. And so I might do like a run at like, maybe I'll do a run at like 11 p.m. to wake myself up. Because you don't want to be the guy who goes to church for the prayer hour and then falls asleep the whole time.
Can you go back to sleep afterwards?
Like,
are you just going to stay up? Yeah.
I was just going to stay up, I think.
Okay.
Wow.
Then, interesting. Yeah. Then maybe doing a run
maybe
before work.
Maybe an evening workout would be beneficial.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe we'll kind of circle back to some of this when we do our cold plunge episode. Because I think there will be some more information that we'll talk about related to like the contrast therapy and how that might affect this. I would say for Jordan's sake, I wouldn't do the contrast therapy for right now. I would just stick to, and I know that's not exactly why you're bringing this up, Caitlin, but I would say, you know, since Jordan only has 3 weeks or so, just do this 2 or 3 times a week, get some of those adaptations in. But I wouldn't mess around with the contrast therapy for right now. Cool. Okay, I think we'll wrap it there.
Sweet.
Thanks, guys.
Cool.
See ya.
See ya.
All right, folks, thanks for tuning in for the latest episode of the Matchbox Podcast. Like I said at the beginning, you can send any questions or topic suggestions to matchboxpod@gmail.com with email titled The Matchbox Podcast. Links to each of our social media pages can be found in the show notes. Tune in next week for another endurance training-related discussion and learn more about how you can find that extra match for your next big event. Catch y'all soon. Let's go!
Can I trust my coach? That's a good question. And we believe that you should totally be asking that question if you're working with a coach. And when it comes to the coaches at Ignition Coach Co., I like to say the proof is in the pudding. Every single one of our coaches has high levels of racing experience. Or in other words, our coaches are fast. And if they're fast, then they can make you fast too. I mean, come on. Who do you want to be your coach? The guy with a clipboard on the sidelines, or the guy with his hands in the air crossing the finish line? I don't know about you, but I'm going with the winner. Sign up for coaching today at ignitioncoachco.com.